The number one skill, number one skill of a mediator is listening. Really careful listening. And we all say it. Again, I am an Irish girl from PEI. I love to chat. And I used to keep a little card inside my binder when I started mediating that just said, stop talking. Just stop talking. Listen. Number one skill. Listen, 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 listen to everyone. What is going on here? Listen.
This is The Every Lawyer, presented by the Canadian Bar Association.
Wherever we find ourselves, be it in Cameroon, in Canada, or in other parts of the world, mediation should be considered as a tool for social change.
I think we have to pivot our minds from using mediation almost exclusively as a legal tool and more towards a community tool. A community tool, but also a skill that each and every one of us can learn. It's not unique to the legal profession. It should be applied a little more broadly, in my opinion.
The conflict resolution or dispute resolution, what we do in our justice system, is an art and science. It's a combination of two. It's not something, the framework is not rigid that we can't be creative.
It also, it creates a space for the peace from the heart, the hurt, right? The need to be listened to. I often will say what people usually need is a really good listening to.
Yeah, a good listening to. I really like it, especially podcasts and their hosts. We always need a good listening to. Welcome to The Every Lawyer. I'm Julia Tetreault-Provencher. Today, I am also a listener. Really, I'm just here to introduce you to Christine Kilby from the CBA Dispute Resolution section, which is sponsoring this episode. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you.
So tell me, what prompted today's episode? I listened to the edit on the weekend, and honestly, I adored it. I learned, I laughed, and it made me think a lot about peace and what it means exactly. And I especially have a soft spot for the part where Esther talks about the warlord saying mommy to her. But I will not say more because the story to get to that point is fascinating, and I want our listeners to have the same surprise as me. But please tell us more about the podcast and how it comes to this.
Thank you, Julia. I had such a wonderful time interviewing these amazing guests and getting to know them and their practice and their perspective. And it really, for me, brought to life this idea that we study when we study constitutional law of peace, order, and good government. And I think what you'll hear with these interviews is how mediation actually supports all of those goals and how all of them work together to create the foundations for peace in society and globally. And this podcast really gave us a global perspective.
Yeah, it very much does. And I would like to know also how you found Joy, Archana, Mina, and Esther.
So Archana and Mina were connections through Mediators Beyond Borders International, which is an organization of precisely that, mediators working for peace around the world. And I was connected to them through someone who's also a member who's located in Canada, Alicia Quinn, and introduced to Alicia by one of our CBA dispute resolution section members, Afsana Gibson Chowdhury. So that was how we started there. We also met Esther that way. And Joy Noonan is a Canadian mediator who I know through the ADR Institute of Ontario and otherwise. So that was the wonderful collection of folks that we were able to bring together for this episode.
Thank you so much for bringing those people to us as well so that we get to listen to them today. And I'd like to know from you, because I said what my feeling after listening to it, but you, when you did this recording, what stayed with you after doing this?
I think two things really stayed with me. And one of them you'll hear me say in the episode, which is the idea that we will never be free of conflict, that peace is a process. It's not a journey to some end point. it's just an ever-present tool to manage the inevitable conflict that comes up in human interactions. And that stayed with me because it feels very, as I said, I think in the recording, just liberating. The other thing that stayed with me was this idea of how when you work on peace, whether it's peace in a lawsuit to settle the case or peace among coworkers, which is something that I do a lot in that field, or in, you know, between warlords and the women they're affecting with their violence, it starts with conversations. It starts with input from the people who are most affected and their thoughts about what is going to bring actual peace and order. And I think it also has a lasting impact when it starts at the grassroots. One of the stories we weren't able to include just because of time was something that Archana was sharing about a study done in Liberia with former child soldiers and how they integrated these former child soldiers back into their communities. And they did so working with the people on the ground, with the communities, getting consultations going to say, like, well, how are we going to actually do this? What are the concerns? And Archana's story ends with someone standing up in that particular seminar where the study was presented and saying, yeah, I'm one of those former child soldiers, that I'm a peace builder now. Like, unreal. So peace has legs, maybe is the is the takeaway.
I like that. I really like that. Well, thank you so much. So let's get started. Up first, we have Elizabeth Joy Noonan. Joy is an accomplished lawyer who shifted her practice in 2007 to that of full-time neutral and conflict resolution work. Joy has served on the Alternative Dispute Resolution, ADR, Institute of Ontario's Board of Directors, and continues to co-chair the ADR Institute of Canada's Chartered Mediator Assessment Committee. Before that, she was a senior partner at a national law firm, and after 20 years in big law.
I remember my long-suffering husband saying, okay, so just so I understand, Joy, you have a plan. Well, I have a plan, you know. So do you have clients? No, I don't have any clients. So you're leaving the partnership and you're going to just, yep, jump off the cliff. I was a senior partner in a big national law firm for many years. And I think I had always been probably the country of Switzerland in the partnership itself. I was often the one called in to sort things out between partners locally and through the country from time to time. But myself, I always had this sneaky feeling that there was a better way. And anybody who's listening, and I see you nodding too, any of us who've practiced law for any period of time, we've done lots of trials, lots of hearings. We've lost cases we should have won. We've won cases where we go, well, that was interesting. But there's so much suffering that happens before you get to that point. And that's only become exacerbated, I might add, over the last 20 years since I've been doing this, where the wait for court is really prolonged now, even worse than it was. But, you know, that brings me back to, you know, feeling there was a better way in my guts and deciding that I would leave private practice and give this a go. And at the time, mediation was much less utilized, but I had a very strong sense that this was what I needed to do. So when you start out, and again, anybody who's doing neutral work knows, when you start out, you kind of have to feel around as to what is going to work. Initially, I did lots of training. I did lots of investigation work, and I built up my mediation practice. Here I am, I guess, 16 years later, I think. I've lost track now. But many years later, and now I really just mediate and arbitrate. But that's how it began. It really began with a feeling that we could do better. And I'm validated in that every single day. We resolve a case and it's faster, it's better, it's cheaper, And now, especially with Zoom and these virtual mediations, it's so much cheaper. So we're able to really cut through the long and painful process of litigation in many, many cases.
That is a very succinct way of putting mediation in the, where I think it belongs in the landscape, which is it's sort of the better way, the more efficient, and sometimes I think the more effective at addressing what actually is going on in a lawsuit.
It lets me as the neutral come in and be that person other than the lawyer who gets to talk directly to a client. Let them express their feelings and brainstorm things together. Let them feel like they're invested in the process. Let them, as you know so well, help them co-create the solution to the problem.
I like the way that you highlight, and I think this is important across the board, the way that mediation makes room for people to collaborate in their solutions, to have agency in deciding what they want to do to solve their problem. And I just wonder if you've seen that or if you have any examples of how that's worked out, maybe in a way that was unexpected even to you, or in a way that beyond the legal context kind of advanced some other priority or goal that may not have been achieved through legal means alone.
Well, you know, I have a great example that this is a couple of years ago now, and it was an in-person mediation. And I'll always remember it was a senior employee in, we'll say, a health organization. And the individual was, I'm going to say, probably over 65 at the time. The lawsuit was an age discrimination-like lawsuit. Dismissal. People in the organization itself were surprised at the sort of vigor with which it was being litigated by the plaintiff, because this individual, she was a female, was always so gentle and so lovely, and they were really shocked at this reaction. And what we found during the mediation process, so, you know, the back and forth and back and forth, what really was needed to get this done was a luncheon. There needed to be a luncheon. I remember going into the employer room and sitting down saying, we need to have a luncheon. We need her to be able to invite the people she worked with. We need to send her off in the proper way. This is not the way to end, right, a 20 plus year career. And you hurt her. You took away her ability to make that call. So let's give her the ability to create the proper exit. So we then spent the next hour working on the, you know, what would the luncheon look like? She gave us the list of all the people she would like invited. And we resolved the case very sensibly, but with a luncheon. Imagine. Yeah, and it's often, that's just one example of, right, hundreds where, you know, smart counsel will quickly read that what's needed sometime is an apology. And not because legally the employer, for example, wasn't entitled to do what the employer did, but just an apology for the way things all rolled out. Or an apology, right? An apology for how things felt. All things that court can't deliver.
I think what I'm realizing hearing from lawyers is they're in a very difficult position in mediation. Because effectively, we're asking them to do a job that is the opposite of their job. So their job is to advocate, to really be the cheerleader, to show the other side why they're going to lose. But then they're coming into a space where we're actually asking them to suspend that discussion and talk about why they might lose and tell their client why it may be in their interests not to fight this case all the way through. And I wonder what you found helps you as the mediator to work with counsel who have to live in those two worlds simultaneously?
That's such a great question, Christine, and it's so true. We ask lawyers to be warriors, right? And that's their job. And then they come to mediation and all of that's supposed to be suspended, and suddenly they're supposed to become expert negotiators. For me, I spend a lot of time with each room, but plaintiffs in particular, and I say that only because often defense are organizations and, you know, it's a little more clinical in that space, but to explain to the parties that the counsel are there to be their advocates, their champions, right? They are here to give you the best legal advice and to fight, fight, fight. And I've got another lawyer in the other room, equally talented, who's going to be advocating and fighting and to defend their client or to support their client. It's the other side of the story. And then I explain that my role is to be that middle, that really people who know me will know I say this all the time. My client is the settlement. So each of you have an advocate. I'm here advocating for the neutral resolution. I'm here for the deal. And so I tell them I'm the one who's going to push your lawyer around. I'm the one who's going to test, you know, we should think about what the outcomes could be here. You know, we should look at the other side so that we're very comfortable whether we take this ultimate settlement or not. You're comfortable that this is the right choice. So I really try, Christine, to recognize and applaud the counsel in their advocacy roles and acknowledge that in each room. That's their job. And explain to the parties that just for today only, we're going to approach this differently. And I'm going to hassle everybody. And I'm going to nudge, 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 push, 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 charm, 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 right? Cajole, just to see whether there's a possibility. And we're going to make sure that at the end, the parties get to make the decision. It's their decision, but let's find out what's possible. And by doing that, I really try to acknowledge the lawyer's dilemma, right? And I know it well. I mean, I had myself done hundreds of mediations before I became a mediator. It's a dilemma.
Archana Medeker and Mina Vaish both have 20 plus years experience as mediators in the Greater Toronto Area. Their professional mediation journey has taken them from litigation via mediation to international peace building through their work with Mediators Beyond Borders.
My name is Mina Vaish, and I've been a mediator for about 18 years in a full-time capacity. Started off in court-connected services here in Ontario, where I reside, and I am currently the manager of operations for court-connected service that services Peel Region and Dufferin Region. Peel, of course, is one of, I would say, Canada's most diverse and populous regions. So there are a lot of challenges around managing the operational side of the court-connected service in the Brampton court location. But I think my passion is always the international work that Archana and I have spent the last, I would say, 10 years sort of honing and really diving into international peace mediation, mediation collaborative processes, and other tools to advance peace building.
My here and now is right now, I am in New York. I am excited to share that I'm attending the Commission on Status of Women at the United Nations headquarters. And that is something that my role as a lawyer and peace builder, and that is a journey. And I want to thank Mina for bringing me into this world of peace building. So just to introduce myself, I am a lawyer and my focus of practice is working on issues that impact women, children, and people with intersectional vulnerabilities adversely. I am a mediator and I do family mediations primarily. And in that role, I see that how we can creatively problem solve. And for our listeners who would be primarily lawyers, I want to share a personal story that brought me from litigation to mediation. So after practicing almost for 20 years hardcore litigation, I was feeling the burnout. Literally, I give example that, you know, the battery cell, I could see the red ring at the bottom and I needed the positivity. And that's where I turned to mediation training. And I trained as a mediator. And I think being a lawyer mediator is definitely complementing and balancing my being as a professional. So I would really encourage people to think that these two things are not diagonally opposite. They can complement each other. They can really make it creative for you to use as a tool. And that was further extended to the world of peace building.
When we talk about mediation in maybe in an Ontario context or Canadian legal context, I think a lot of people who practice law will have a certain idea of what that looks like. And I wonder if you have a different understanding of mediation or a different experience with it in an international context or particularly a peace context. So maybe you can help us understand what do they look like, mediation here, mediation there, and how are they different and similar?
I can start off. And I think it's good that we actually define mediation because I do believe there are different permutations and understanding of what actually mediation is. So I think it's a good idea to talk about some of the principal elements. So at its core, mediation is a voluntary process on consent of the parties, where a neutral, impartial, and independent facilitator assists the parties to come to a mutually agreeable resolution on a dispute or a conflict. And it is based on the principles of self-determination and informed consent. So some of the fundamental words in this definition, Christine, are, of course, voluntary, neutral, impartial, independent. But to me, the most important words are self-determination and informed consent. So self-determination, meaning that the parties themselves have a say in the outcome. They craft their own solutions. They use their creativity to arrive at a mutually agreeable resolution. And sometimes it doesn't happen, but often it does. So all of those above sort of principles are really important for an effective mediation. But to distinguish that perhaps a little bit, and I think there are a lot of similarities to international peace mediation, but there are some differences, of course. So international peace mediation is a type of mediation where a mediator or mediators, generally someone that is respected and trusted by the parties themselves, assists two or more sides to come to a peace agreement or sets in place the steps to achieve that particular peace agreement. And it could start as simply as the negotiations around ceasefires, for example.
What have you observed in the work you're doing in the relationship between maybe the sort of grassroots work and how it impacts on bigger policy around the world?
Peace building it's a holistic intervention. And so its objective is to sort of build the nutrients. When we talk about the nutrients of positive peace and the nutrients that support sustainable peace, some of those nutrients are things that align with the UN Sustainable Development Goals, gender equality, poverty elimination, human rights protection, access to justice, rule of law. The UN architecture of peace building actually defines it as an effort to assist countries and regions in their transition from war to peace, but also to reduce a country's risk of lapsing or relapsing into conflict by strengthening national capacities for conflict management and laying the foundations for sustainable peace and development. So there's your linkage. The linkage is sustainable peace, some of our beliefs really requires access to conflict resolution tools such as mediation, but also national capacities in laying the foundations for sustainable peace. But in terms of relevance to Canada, we have to remember that peace building is a dynamic process. It is ever changing and ever demanding. In fact, it is a fallacy to assume peaceful societies such as Canada do not require investment in peace building because it's dynamic, it changes. There are environmental, social, political change that can challenge peace anywhere in the world. And we have a responsibility to invest in sustainable peace ingredients, I would call them.
We hear a lot of talk about the divisions in society, the polarities emerging in many different places around the world. And I just wonder, does the investment in capacity and in peace building, both in a capacity level and an infrastructure level, is that the bulwark against that kind of division or those negative forces?
I think that's an excellent question. We broadly say that mediation is peace building. And we talk about people-centered justice and local capacity building and creating more peaceable world at Mediators Beyond Borders. And at the core of it is, as you said, we are at a pivot point in our lives at this point in time. There is much progress on technology, which has potential to connecting us. And ironically, this is the time that we are most polarized. And the biggest challenge we have is how to bring these polarized people or parties or organizations or nations to come together and create something. And the question is, how can that happen? Who will make that happen? And when is the right time? It is actually on us. This is the time and we can make it happen. And for that, what we need to do is build each person's capacity, irrespective of professional background, to pitch in their own way to peace. Peace doesn't necessarily mean something which we always said. There are two faces of peace, and there was a concept of positive peace, which was popularized by a peace theorist, Johan Galtung, and he just passed away. He was a Norwegian mathematician, and he actually was the founder of conflict and peace studies. And he taught us that peace does not mean absence of war. Peace does not mean absence of violence, or negative peace is known as absence of violence or fear of violence. So he coined the term positive peace, and that is the attitude. Positive peace is not just the goal, but institutions, structures, including the justice system, to create sustainable peace in the society. He says that peace is not a goal. Peace is a process. So positive peace is presence of justice. And that can happen in any sphere in the society. It could be the need for being trauma-informed. If that means the core of justice, we need to have that in the spaces where we are. Positive peace focuses on actions and interactions. And I think interaction part is what is making us really continue to be polarized, because we don't have platforms where we can sit down or facilitate the conversations where people are not agreeable to each other's points of view. And I think it is very simple. It involves acts of kindness by one person to the other. One major part of this is teaching or educating people about helping the individuals or groups to have meaningful conversation or dialogue. I think that mediation has that quality of having the open dialogue sometimes, you know, to transform and to heal if that is required. Basically, we have to think that people have capacity to learn. The parties in conflict have capacity to learn the position of the other party. Whether they agree or not is a different story. But the concept of listening to the listener while mediating, we are observing what's happening between the parties as a dynamics. And our role is to balance the power dynamics. And that is true irrespective of whether it's the regular mediation, two-party mediation, or multi-party complex peace mediation. So some of these things are based on just the human connection. I think mediation connects human beings with empathy, and that's the wholeness of us being human. So it's a very powerful process.
I love what you said about listening to the listener. What does that mean? What does that look like in practice?
Listening to the listener is basically being self-conscious as or self-oriented as a mediator, because my role as a mediator is going to influence the parties. I bring power to the table, but my power should not influence them, because we strongly believe in people's right to self-determination in mediation. That was my biggest transition or transformation, being a litigator to mediator, was we have to learn to break the compulsion to step in or to solve people's problems or, you know, give them solution, saying that I understand this, I'm an expert, you know, this is the best way, this should work for you and your family or your organization or your country. And I think we have to break that compulsion and allow that space for the parties. Listen to what's happening, listen to their body language, listen to the power dynamics that's playing out, and there is always power dynamics. We have to be the ones creating the safe space and making sure that we allow people and empower them through our process to find their own solution. And those things we see in litigation, that sometimes when there is only one party who would have a buy-in in a court order, the other party who is not satisfied keeps on coming back to the court. And that's why we want to have a process, and there could be always a mix and match, that we can stop being a hindrance and help people to empower to come up with their own decision making. And how do we do that is by listening to the listener. What one party says, how is it impacting the other? That's my role as a mediator, to make sure that I don't say, okay, let me help you. This is the good thing. At that point in time, I think helping becomes real hindrance. I believe that we are not the bystander neutrals in mediation. My mediation guru and the founder of Mediators Beyond Borders International, he has coined a fascinating term called omnipartial. And that term means I am on the side of every party. That fascinating term liberated my soul in mediation, but in practice, it would mean that we create a safe space, empower the parties for self-determination.
I've heard you talk about together the idea that sustainable peace is a really critical concept, right? To prevent relapse. And you've talked about how peace, positive peace, is not the absence of conflict, because that it's peace process, right? There will always be conflict, which I find personally very liberating as an idea, right? That we're not trying to get to some end point. There is no end point. Where there are people, there are conflicts. And so the question becomes, how do we manage them? And so it sounds to me like you have, and again, I'm thinking about your levels, right? You have international players that face each other in certain places and in certain ways. And they have tools and agreements about how they want to do things. And then you have within countries the way people do things. And so I wonder, as you are developing capacity, as you are building that kind of positive peace infrastructure, it seems to me, Mina, you talked about people having skills that come from mediation, that there's a couple of different levels of capacity where there's like an institutional kind of structural piece that we can develop in a province or a city or a village. And then there's like people's actual own skills in managing conflict and to you know, go back to what Archana was saying, to be able to hear each other. Maybe they don't agree, but to hear each other. So I just wonder, how does that look on the ground, maybe from the work you're doing? What have you borrowed from the international framework or from international peace building to build capacity more locally and individually?
I love the metaphor of water when I'm, you know, when I'm teaching my classes and whatnot. So how does the global and local kind of link? I always use this metaphor and I love it because it really sort of trains your mind to think. When we talk about water and precipitation, it falls from a high level to a low level. It falls from the sky and it comes down to earth. But there's also, so that what I call a top-down impact of various peace-building initiatives. from global to local. But there's also the second part of the water cycle, and that is evaporation and condensation. So that's from bottom up, in that you've got what's percolating on the ground will affect what happens globally. And as we know, clouds merge. There are no borders for clouds. So they move forward, they move to another jurisdiction, another country, and they may fall somewhere else. That precipitation may fall in another country. So what we're doing locally in Canada, when we talk about some of the ingredients that build peace, rule of law, access to justice, gender equality, you know, mediation as a tool, and yes, nations must invest more in peace-building tools. We see a lot of investment in war and conflict and military. We don't see enough in peace building. What we do in Canada locally will affect what happens globally, and vice versa. What's happening globally will impact and affect us locally.
Esther Omam started out mediating already as a young girl, first between her family members and then between couples she met in church. In May of 2019, she addressed the UN Security Council in New York on the humanitarian crisis in Cameroon and the impact it has had on women, children, health, and humanitarian access. As executive director of Reach Out Cameroon, Esther has been at the forefront of mediation and development issues in the southwest region of Cameroon since 2000, coordinating humanitarian activities in the southwest and northwest regions and supporting more than 350,000 internally displaced persons, including those in hard-to-reach communities in both regions. A natural-born mediator. She is awesome, and you're going to love her.
Yes, I will not put parties to this current conflict, or I will not give names. I know of this man who is so dreaded in the communities. Many people feared him so much for his fierceness, brutality, and all. Nobody will want to talk to him. People were so much afraid. And I started asking myself, how do I get closer to this man to talk to him? What will I do? And then I asked one or two people confidentially, whom I knew I could trust. Because if this filtered and he got it, he would get me killed. So they said, we will not dare. Because where he is, he's already seeing you. So people even believe in some kind of extranatural. So they said, we will not give you the number because if we talk to you, he will hear us. And I started explaining to them. I said, no, he will not. He will not. Where he is, he will not. It's just because of, you know, the aura he surrounded himself with, which is that of fierceness and so on, which makes people believe that he has supernatural powers. But please, you just give me the contact. And they say, are you sure? I say, yes. They say, okay, I will not give you another person who will give you the contact. And I spoke to that person in all humility and modesty. And the person respected me and said, okay, I will give you the number. And so he passed the number. Before passing the number, he made a tripartite call, spoke to the guy, and then said, I'm passing you to one whom we consider a respected mother to us. And I spoke with him in all calmness, you know, using the soft touch of women, bringing the motherly aspect to it. And so he was listening until at some point I heard him say, Mommy, Mommy, I hear you. Mommy, one day I will see you because you are really a mother. Thank you, Mommy. But you know, we will not stop. I said, never say never again, because the unpredictable can happen. And he said, how will I see you one day when everything is over? I will look for you. Because the way you touched me in a special way made me think about my mother. So you see, this is somebody who is considered dreaded, and people will not want to talk to him. People believe that he had supernatural powers, but I could break through that wall and speak to him in a calmer way, you know, and making him to feel loved and making him to be my point of concern, of interest. And so this made him to succumb, you know, to also break the glass wall around him, calm down his high pedestal, and address me like an ordinary human being. What brought me into mediation? I will say it's a calling. It's a vocation. I didn't prepare for this. In my early childhood age, I discovered myself mediating conflicts, disagreements within the family as young as I was. I remember this instance where my elder sister got married to somebody my late father considered as not responsible, and he chased my elder sister out of the house. I had to step in with my little voice, talk to my dad, and he was always listening to me. Talk to him, make him see reason to accept my sister. At some point, he slapped her before sending her out of the house. And so when I cried and I spoke to him, he understood and said, it's okay, you can go and bring her. I remember traveling to go look for my sister, spoke to her, and then she came and they reconciled. First of all, you know the patriarchal nature of our families in Africa, in Cameroon specifically, which does not allow the girl child, you know, to take preeminence over the male child. But my father had a special love for me. I don't know. Maybe because he saw that gift in me, which was, I always empathized with people. I will always take people's cases on me as if I was the one, you know, who was that victim. And so this is how it went. And most people in church and beyond understood that I will always be impartial in all what I'm called to do. I will never take side, but I will see, I will make people see a reason. And I will make them communicate clearly their issues, you know, try and then establish trust through confidentiality. Because what matters the most is for people to come and tell you their deepest secret, and the next moment they hear them out there, you know. It's for people to come and tell you stuff, and the next day they hear them out there. This is what people will not want to, and people will not want to identify themselves with such persons who portray such character. And I'm sure that this was one of the attitudes, the principles, which led to people coming to me or trusting, coming to me without fear or trusting my approach. You know.
So your impartiality, your ability to let them be understood by each other, and then most importantly, the confidentiality, not going around in the street the next day telling people secrets, was incredibly important. And people trusted that.
Yes. And most of the time, all of them who came, you know, I would do that voluntarily. Nobody forced me to do that. And it was also on a voluntary basis that they would decide to come, because If you think you're putting money over the issue, I will tell you to go. So most of them came at that earlier stage because it was a kind of selfless initiative. That was the early beginning of that journey, which I never knew was going to mark me in the later years somehow. And so this is how I find myself doing this. And I love doing it in schools with people, young people in the communities, women who had issues of disagreement with one another. And then the church, every couple in the church who had problems will come to me. And so I will be the mediator. I remember instances where I will sit to mediate couples' issues up to late hours of the night to the detriment of my health, simply because I wanted them to understand each other. I wanted them to come to compromise. I wanted them to be together. And this I'm happy because they are living today to give the testimonies. They are living today to say how impactful that which I did has been in their lives, which have made them to commit to one another. And then it became a community affair where I was solicited in the communities. I started doing this with no professional skills or knowledge, but I was doing that. And so later on, we had partners who came on board and who started giving us the skills and knowledge. I remember UNDP with UN Women Cameroon, who gave the very basics of that. Then women mediators across the Commonwealth and mediators without borders came on board to impact this knowledge. And since then, I've been mediating, be it couples, groups, friends, communities, and most especially the Anglophone crisis as well.
All of these principles of mediation, impartiality, confidentiality, voluntariness, they're important in every sphere, but how did you become involved? Tell us about the Anglophone crisis, what it is, how it started, and your involvement.
Yeah, before talking about my involvement in the Anglophone crisis, there is need to make a connection with the Bakassi crisis. The Bakassi crisis is a crisis which was between Nigeria and Cameroon, and which cost so many lives and pains, and where women were silenced, you know, through threats, intimidation, and they had no voice. So at some point, people had to travel one day and a half to get to me. I mean, the leaders, traditional leaders, to get to me to say they've heard so much about what I've been doing and they've never seen me there. And my office was always going there. And because of the high level of insecurity, we will not go there anyhow. But when they came, it touched me and I said, my life, all throughout my life, I've been working, dedicating my life for people. It's important that I go to these people. And so I yielded to their call and I went there and I saw and I heard, and it broke the system in me because I could not imagine that people will live in such pains and suffering within the same country where I lived without anyone giving a listening ear or attending to the issues which were happening in that area. The women spoke, the youth spoke, pleaded, begged me to come to their rescue. And I told them I was not the savior because I had no means. But when I went back to my office with my collaborators, we did deep analysis of all what we heard and saw, which was happening there in terms of human rights abuses, in terms of high levels of gender-based violence, discrimination, marginalization. We submitted this to our board, which approved that we should focus in that area. And so much happened where we did serious mediation work, you know, and negotiation, so many negotiation sessions, which led to the birth of the Bakassi Women for Peace Task Force, which became a household name in the country some years after the head of state had to receive these women. And they took part, these women who were completely cut off from the national life. They never had an identity or whatsoever, you know. were integrated into the national events in order to gain citizenship and a voice. And after that happened, we saw many of them struggling to become something within their communities. And today they are mayors, they are in the Senate, they are entrepreneurs, they are academicians, scholars, as I would put it. And they've greatly improved in terms of their status as women. And when some of them sit in events, I am bound to bow before them, because in the face of when you meet a senator, you know, you pay allegiance, you have to give her that respect. These were women who were not so educated then, whom we encouraged to go to school, and they decided to go to school to some level, middle way, and finally they pushed their agenda through. We also drilled them, coached them on how they could prepare for elections using clear agenda and so on. And so when the Anglophone crisis started, we were mainly focusing on key stakeholders like the highest administrative authorities in the region, talking to them, trying to make them see what will happen if care is not taken, and predicting doom and chaos if care is not taken, trying to advise on what possible method or solutions we should be considered. Then we have not seen the atrocious activities. We didn't know that things would deteriorate. And when they deteriorated, women became the center of attraction, because these women who started bearing the brunt of it all with their children, losing their husbands, children, family members to the crisis. It is women who were denied access to their farms, knowing that 60% of our women live on farm resources, farm products, being denied access to markets because of fear of the guns, being refused access to better healthcare services because of the destruction of the healthcare services, the killing and targeting of health personnel, their children being denied access to education. And so all of this made us to pay special attention to what was happening. And we began with humanitarian support to internally displaced persons. But when we were going to the communities where we're going, where we established so many cooperatives, groups, and where women were at the center of those cooperative groups and at the center of all our activities, and when we discovered that there was total destabilization of these communities, we could not find our beneficiaries. People have fled to other towns. We tried doing mapping and contact tracing. And through the contact tracing, we discovered some hubs, which were IDP hubs, and we found some of our beneficiaries there. We went beyond our region, you know, to get to know. And that's how we started getting to know that our beneficiaries had fled as far as in many other regions. This was not something to take lightly. And then we said, how do we do this? We had to analyze critically in order to see what to do. We say, before, it was Nigeria versus Cameroon. So we could impact as Richard Cameroon. We could do it alone as an organization. Now it is something which concerns Cameroonians versus Cameroonians. Even though we are talking about separation, there was not call for separation before, because we had lived as one country. So it was Cameroonians versus Cameroonians. How do we do it? It dawned on us that we would not be able to carry that mandate as an organization as we did in Bakassi. That's why we brought on board other women leaders that we knew. We consulted with four, with me making five, who accepted in my region, the Southwest region, where we are headquartered. So we decided, I called them, gave them the vision, came up with a name which was close to the name which the Bakassi women used, because it was Bakassi Women for Peace Task Force. Now that the conflict ended, I told them that the conflict is in the Southwest and in the Northwest. So let us just say Southwest Northwest Women's Task Force, you know, to emulate what the Bakassi women did. And this, we'll talk about it when we talk about transformation, when we talk about impact, that was one of it. And so we learned from what we did and we created that voice space for the Anglophone women who had never thought of becoming peace builders because they had never suffered any war. They had never been at any war front. They've never seen one besides the one which we all contributed to supporting our government, which was in the far north. Bakassi had ended, so we had that of the far north, where most Cameroonians were pulling resources together to support government, to support the soldiers at the front lines. But we brought the women together and we said, okay, what do we do? Let us just see how we will carry on. And the first, we coached them on how to do humanitarian support or response. And this was the first activities we did with the women. And when we wanted to do the second, after analysis, we told them that there would be burnouts. We do not have salaries. We do not have money. Where are we going to get money to support displaced person all the time? There is need to move a step further and start doing advocacy. So this is how we started doing advocacy and we decided to get into mediation. We started contacting administrative authorities, religious and traditional leaders, as well as try to find out who the leaders of the non-state armed groups were. But then it was so violent and people were being killed every day that we could not get them systematically as we had government, because government was in the country. We could see them, we could reach out to them and talk to them. And with them, we had to look for means of getting contacts. And that's how we led the first lamentation campaign, which served as a bridge between the government and the non-state armed groups, trying to call for inclusive dialogue from both sides, try to call for a ceasefire, try to call for a reconsideration of positions.
How do you reach people who are so violent or engaged in such a high stakes conflict? How do you reach them?
Yeah, one thing we should know is that you have women who always have the soft touch, and women are mothers, they are sisters. And we had to use our women's approach, mothers and sisters approach, to get the contacts of these people and to talk to them, trying to communicate to government and to them as the same way, in an objective manner, without discrimination, or without siding with anyone. So we found the contacts and we got them. When we wanted to carry out the lamentation campaign, the very first activity, we gave responsibility to some women to contact them and tell them that the women, the mothers, are coming out, and we are coming out because we see our people dying, destruction going around us, and we cannot bear it. So they should know and they should take note. And the same way we did with government.
So you came as mothers, as sisters, saying, we've had enough. People are suffering. People are dying. It's time for us to step in and sort this out. And you better be ready for us. Here we come.
Yes. And please listen to us. And then we talk to one party and then we talk to the other.
And they listened. I mean, they let you in. They didn't. You're talking about people dying, just the incredible danger of the situation. What do you think gave you the opportunity to come in without?
What gave us leverage is the numbers and our ability to navigate from one party to the other. Yeah. So from one party to the other without taking any side. I remember very well there was a time when they started beheading women, dehumanizing women, killing women in an atrocious way, and it made waves all over the country, and nobody would do anything. So I was not around then. So when I came back, I looked at the situation, and people were marching, protesting in other towns, and I told them, no, we have to go where the scene, where it happened. That is where we'll have the impact. And at some point, even when they were killing school children, and at some point they killed up to 7, we could no longer take it. But, you know, we will not take side if we wanted to be on good side of both parties. What we did is that we mobilized ourselves. Unfortunately for me that day, after working to mobilize 300, 4,500 women came out. And 4,500 women came out. And that is what caused the turn of events. And then we spoke out to all the parties, bringing out the messages and trying to tell them that we are neither nor. We are here just to make sure that this stops. And we remember that the communicator of the non-state armed groups, the then communicator of the non-state armed groups, who was in the U.S., came out and make a public declaration by video, saying that what these women have done has never happened. So they who claim to be leaders who are doing this should be careful, because it will never be the same again. They should stop what they are doing from now moving henceforth. They should take the fight and what they are doing to the opposite or opposing regions. I don't know how to put it. I want to put it in a mild way, that they should take it to the Francophone regions. They should go and do the killings there and so on. And it should stop in the Anglophone regions. And that is how the killing of school children and women stopped.
Wow.
So, yes, and stopped. So, in another instance, I had to lead a delegation of three in the U.S. to meet with the leaders of the non-state armed groups. People never believed. All the systems and the international organizations, they never believed that it would be possible. They thought we were kidding. But we did that. We went there. They came from all the states where they were to answer to the call, which I made. And they locked us in the room for 4 hours, 30 minutes. It was a session. 4 hours, 30-minute session. It was not a kid's play, a child's play. And we walked them through our analysis. And they also, we were trying to speak. They also spoke, but before doing that, we had already spoken with the government. We met with the government before going to them because we knew that it will never be possible for these two to come together. We had to go to government. We spoke with government. We tried getting the government stand on this. And then we also decided to go to them and so on. And then we came back. And by that time, schools really were at 15% operational. But after that, they became a little bit flexible to allow children in some towns going, even they said, even without uniform, but some students were going with uniforms and others were going without uniform in some of the remote parts. And then we started monitoring and we discovered that by then we had 48% going to school. And today we are far more above 50% going to school. So this is what happened.
It sounds like what motivated your movement in the beginning was this idea of humanitarian relief, supporting displaced people, supporting people to be able to attend school, supporting women who were not on their farms, not able to sort of do the work they were doing to subsist and also to make money. And then you sort of stumble into brokering peace, essentially, where nobody thought that was possible, being a shuttle diplomat to
non-state armed groups
and coming back full circle to let's get the kids back to school. Let's enfranchise the members of our community who are the least enfranchised. I mean, it sounds like full circle back home on the ground, reducing the impact of war on the most vulnerable members of society.
Yes, that was it. And I want us to understand that usually people perceive mediation at times as everybody being around a table. But we came to discover that mediation should go beyond that. It's not just bringing people around the table all the time. There are times when you will not be able to bring all the parties to the table, but you should be able to navigate between one party to the other, talk to them, get their interests and the options, you know. And this we did in Bakassi so well that it yielded positive fruits. And this we also tried doing here, even though we are still to see the end of the conflict. We have been working in these communities through the development for many years before the conflict started. And we had to switch to a humanitarian organization and later on to a peace mediation organization, because we discovered that you cannot talk, humanitarian when you do not link it with peace, or when you do not bring in aspects of negotiations. Yes, you cannot do that. At first, it seemed strange for people seeing me navigating between humanitarian response and peace building activities, and then mediating the conflict at all fronts. And people were saying, oh, that's too political. We were doing that. We had done that before. We succeeded in Bakassi. We were doing that in the course of the Anglophone crisis. Mediation comes to reinforce all what we do in humanitarian response, if at all we want to lead the communities afflicted to stabilization. So this is what Richard has been doing. We've been doing that as the pioneer organization, you know, in carrying out humanitarian response before other organizations will come on board, because people were afraid. Remember, they were burning cars, killing people randomly, and so on. We have been working in those communities for the many years, and the communities knew us and understood us. And so there was a way we could navigate in order to go to the communities on notice and carry out activities to give them the reassurance and hope they needed to get why things were falling apart. And so we did, is it wash, food distribution, we put in place mobile health clinics because of the disruption of the health system, which was broken already. And we started doing, besides the health mobile clinics, we started doing the peace sexual reproductive health clinics and going to the communities, putting this together and doing community dialogue together.
You need to know the culture, the context, to really be able to serve and hear
it. Of course. Knowledge of the local reality is, like the French people say, is something you cannot underestimate. The Frenchman say, incontournable. It is something you must hold so dear.
Mm-hmm.
The culture of the people. If you do not understand their daily local realities, it will be difficult for you to understand the issues in order for you to better facilitate for a better resolution of the disagreements or conflicts which they live daily.
You've worked with Canadians, Esther, and you know them through the UN and other international groups. What do Canadians have to contribute, or even in the international sphere? How do we go about supporting that work of peace with the humility that we don't understand the day-to-day cultural reality on the ground?
Many times, most mediators will carry their big suitcases and get themselves into a context, a particular context and country, and then they just remain static to what they know about mediation without being flexible, trying to understand what's happening in that community in terms of local realities and so on, attitudes, whatever, the culture, which are very important to understand. You know, they will remain static to the agenda. And this is what falls or stalls most processes at times. We need to go beyond that. And a case in point, I keep telling people, is the experience I had in Bakassi. Even though I live in the Southwest region, even though Bakassi is in the Southwest region, they are in the maritime and they have specific cultures, which if you do not look at carefully, you miss the point in all what is happening. And this is how we were able to succeed to bridge the gap and make them have a U-turn to consider the various options which they put on the table in order to come to a possible agreement with regards to child early forced marriages, where the chiefs were getting younger children as young as 12 to 14 years old, some taken even as early as 10 years old. So we needed to understand the culture. Another, to convince, make them see the need to have a shift from the position of getting girls as young as 10 to 12 years to a desirable result. So if these are not considered, it will be difficult. We know Canadians have mediators, and we know that they follow the conventional way, the usual routine of following up the mediation principles, the outlining exactly what everyone knows, you know, but forgetting that trust and culture are essential parts of mediation. If you want to succeed, get into the minds of the people. And for you to get into the minds of the people, why do you get into the minds of the people? You get into the minds of the people because you want to understand how they live, how they act daily, how they go about doing their things daily. What are those things that bind them together, which make them to do what they are doing? Mm-hmm. And why they are doing that. So we have very good professionals, mediators, and so on, but we are coming from the grassroots, and we can only echo a reflection of what the grassroots is all about. And you know, most conflicts, usually we know conflicts differ, they differ from one stage to other, one level to the other, one setting to the other. The most conflict usually emanate from grassroots. Look at the Anglophone crisis. Look at the Bakassi crisis. It was affecting with the communities. Look at the Anglophone crisis. Who are the people bearing the brunt of it all? Our communities. Not even the people who live in the city or ACs in their offices. So we sit in ACs in our offices, and then we bring suitcases trying to superimpose or impose what we think should be and not what the people want.
Right. So we're literally with baggage.
And we should know that though conflicts have commonalities, there are specificities which should be considered. It's not because it worked in country A, that would definitely work in country B. Why? So the question we should ask ourselves today is why? Why is it not working all around? Is because there are some elements which have escaped our understanding and which we do not want to take into consideration when facilitating or mediating.
What, in your opinion, makes for the best mediators? What are the qualities?
Okay. So you want us to talk about the qualities of what makes a good mediator? I know it's written in books. We say it every day. We are trained to be professional mediators. But in simpler terms, what makes a good mediator is one who is very impartial and who seriously look out for issues of conflicts of interest when carrying out when facilitating or carrying out this mediation role. It's one who does it voluntarily, you know, like giving himself, his body, soul to that exercise that will make the other people feel comfortable, that will make both parties feel comfortable to always have you around. And one who practices neutrality is very important, and the aspects of confidentiality. One who considers confidentiality as key, and one who is also a good listener, and who communicates well to the understanding of both parties to the conflict. And there is one I forgot, and one who is ready to let go.
Say more about that.
I forgot about this last one. One who is ready to let go. Many a time we impose ourselves. We force ourselves into a role which is not ours. And even when the people insist that they don't want us, we still impose ourselves, we insist. There is a time when you look at people's faces, even when they don't speak out, you understand that, yeah, I am not wanted. Don't force it. Let it go. And at some point, they will understand and say, but why did he go? Why did he not insist? And so, and they will come looking for you. So you should be able to let go at some point when you see that the atmosphere is not the best. Don't force it.
Thank you so much for listening to us today, and please reach out to us anytime at podcast@cba.org. And remember to subscribe for more great, roughly bi-monthly episodes of The Every Lawyer. Have a beautiful day.